This is All Things Considered on 90.1 WABE. I'm Dennis O'Hare. As Georgia expands its nuclear energy production capacity, the political campaign will probably focus, at least to some degree, on what our energy course will be in the future. Among the people watching it very closely, Daniel Yergin, who is chairman of IHS Cambridge Energy Research Associates. His latest book, a bestseller, by the way, The Quest, Energy, Security, and the Remaking of the Modern World. He is here in Atlanta for a conference with former Georgia Senator Sam Nunn on energy policy and our security future. Dr. Yergin, welcome. Good to have you.
Thank you.
A book on energy as a New York Times bestseller, what does that tell you?
Well, it says that energy is really on people's minds. It's a big issue for the country, big issue for our economy, a big issue for our national security, and people have a lot of questions and I think rightfully have a lot of anxiety about it.
During the presidential campaign lately, there has been a whole lot of talk about gasoline prices, and the accusation from several of the Republican candidates was that the president's energy secretary wanted to see European-level gasoline prices. Is that, though, in the long run, a higher price for energy actually the kind of thing that will make us more secure, as politically difficult as it might be?
I think it's a mixed picture because higher gasoline prices, particularly at this time in our struggling economic recovery, take a real toll, take money out of people's pockets, and send those dollars overseas. But in response to kind of higher prices, we're seeing a lot of innovation going on, and we're also seeing that new, much more efficient automobiles are going to come into the market. That's not the result of price, that's the result of regulation that says 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025. So I think we are going through a period in which I call a kind of great bubbling of a lot of energy innovation. It's driven by, you know, policies, by prices, and it's also driven by security concerns about instability in other parts of the world.
Given the instability in other parts of the world, have we waited too long? I mean, we've talked about more efficient cars since going back to before the Carter administration, and yet we have slowed down the development and the mandates on efficient cars. Have we waited too long?
I think what happened is that we achieved the targets that were put in place in 1975. They weren't raised until 2007, and they've now been, under the Bush administration, now been accelerated under the Obama administration. So, you know, our automobile fleet takes 7 or 8 or 10 years to turn over, so these more efficient cars take time to come into the fleet. But we have reached, I think, in the United States, a situation that I call in the Quest peak demand, that we have reached the high point of oil demand in this country a few years ago, and our oil demand is going to go down, partly because we have more efficient vehicles, partly because there's a limit to how many miles a year people can actually drive, and partly changing demographics in our population. So all those things. So in the United States, we have a situation now where our oil demand is going down, and our domestic oil production is going up. It's increased 20% since 2008. So our energy balance looks different. It looks better. But at the same time, there's an enormous amount of risk right now that surrounds the Middle East, and in particular around Iran and its nuclear program.
Former Speaker Gingrich talked a lot about $2.50 per gallon gas if we would simply expand our domestic production. And by domestic, he also meant, I guess, North American production. Is that oil, though, the kind of thing that could be produced efficiently and quickly enough to make a difference?
We have seen quite a dramatic increase in U.S. oil production, and it's up about a million barrels a day since 2008. That's about almost a 20% increase. If we hadn't had that additional oil in the market today, we would be looking at gasoline prices that are a lot higher than they are right now. So additional production anywhere in the world, including the United States, makes a difference. What happens with oil prices, though, is going to be driven, I think, in the near term by geopolitical concerns, which would basically mean tension with Iran, its nuclear program, and also what happens with economic recovery around the world. Those are two very dynamic factors that will actually shape what we're paying at the gasoline pump 6 months or a year from now.
So is the United States still dependent on unreliable sources?
Well, we don't get that much of our oil anymore from the Middle East. Most of our biggest source of oil is our neighbor to the north, Canada. That's 25% of our imports. So the balance is changing. But the basic fact is there is only one world oil market. So Norway exports a lot of oil, but they pay the same oil price as everybody else. So, you know, even as our imports go down, our security position improves, our resilience improves, but we're still going to be affected by what happens in this global marketplace.
Talk about nuclear for a moment. Here in Georgia, we had the first newly approved nuclear power plants in quite a long time. Then Fukushima happened, and there were a lot of questions about the safety of plants from forces beyond our control. Have those questions been answered, or are they still out there?
I think that people, of course, are intensively studying what happened in Fukushima. It was an accident that shouldn't have happened. It appears, and the Japanese government has said this, is that they simply did not integrate the risks of a tsunami with their nuclear power plants. And I quote in the Quest a Japanese government study that said, you know, we had studied intensively earthquakes, but for tsunamis, we'd relied upon fables, stories, you know, what happened in 927 or something like that. And if the backup power for that power plant had been put in a safer place where it was not vulnerable, the accident almost certainly wouldn't have happened. So, you know, it is like all things is, you know, to think the unthinkable, to think about what people hadn't thought about. And I think that's a lesson. Obviously, those were pretty early nuclear power plants, and the plants that are being built here in Georgia are state-of-the-art. So you have 40 years or more of really knowledge that's gone into them, so they're not the same kind of plants. So I think we've learned a lot, and I think that, you know, Fukushima has been scrutinized very carefully, and that that the plants that are built today have safety features and approaches to safety that simply weren't on the agenda when the Fukushima plant was built.
Is there a way, though, to think of everything that could happen? One of the concerns of opponents of nuclear power is that no matter how safe you make them, there's probably something you haven't thought of.
Well, I think in anything, there's one of the themes that's always interested me is surprise, that it's how the unthinkable then turns out to happen. Obviously, with something as complex and as studied as carefully, a nuclear power plant is looked at very carefully. Operations are critical, that they're operated at the right level. I mean, the nuclear accident at Chernobyl happened because they were carelessly doing an experiment in the middle of the night. So, I mean, I think we have a very rigorous system of operations that goes back to the nuclear navy and one of the characters in the Quest, Admiral Rickover, and that kind of ethic of focus on performance is central for nuclear power, as it is for any of complex industrial activities that are part of modern life.
So is nuclear power then a part of our energy mix for as far as we can see in the future, or is it a bridge to other technologies that may be safer in the end?
Everybody's focused on innovation and technology. That includes nuclear and the question of how will nuclear designs change in the future? Will we have small modular nuclear power plants? Nuclear today is about 20% of our electricity, and it's what they call the base load. You depend upon it, unlike wind or sun, which vary with the wind or the time of day and so forth, and what's happening with weather and clouds. I think as a country, after 2020, we'll face the question whether we start to replace our nuclear power plants or we don't. And that will be a big question for the stability of our electric system, because nuclear is part of the base load upon which we depend. And obviously, when you're talking about nuclear power and the length of time it takes to build a plant, you really are thinking very long term.
Real quickly on natural gas, we are increasing our natural gas production at a tremendous rate and using the technology that we hadn't even envisioned perhaps a few years ago. But there are concerns about fracking and its effect Are those concerns justified? I mean, even last week there were people saying, well, does it cause some of these earthquakes and so forth that have happened in different parts of the country? Do we know yet what's true and what's not about the effect of fracking?
I served on a commission last year for the Secretary of Energy that was charged by President Obama with doing a study on the environmental aspects of shale gas. And so we looked at each of the aspects, and the conclusions that we came to, that the concern about hydraulic fracturing itself in terms of chemicals, the scientists on the committee said extremely unlikely to affect water supply because of the depths and so forth and the volumes. The primary concerns were, what do you do with the wastewater? What about air pollution and community impact? And each of those are real questions, and each of them has to be managed. And we said that, you know, between a combination of best practices, between regulation, much of it done by states, and technological innovation, they're all amenable to solutions as we get to this very large scale. Shale gas now is 37% of our total natural gas supply from 2% a decade ago. So it's developed very fast. It's changed the economics. It's created a lot of jobs. It means we're not importing LNG. But these environmental questions have to be taken seriously and addressed in a pragmatic and realistic way. The more recent concerns is about what impact on earthquakes. We had the governor of Ohio at a recent conference that we put on who talked about earthquakes, which seemed to be connected to what's called the reinjection of wastewater and that it was improperly done. And so one consequence is that that, too, is going to be a much more regulated activity in the future. So the whole process requires, you know, the right kind of regulation as it grows so rapidly and brings economic benefits that weren't expected. It's created 600,000 jobs in the last few years, which is a number President Obama had in a State of the Union address. So this is a great resource, but it has to be managed, like all such resources, properly.
But you mentioned the regulation would come from the states. Do states have, A, the financial wherewithal to do this, to put the kind of oversight in that would be needed, and B, we've seen a lot of questions about how well state governments can withstand the kind of lobbying pressure that might be put on them to keep the regulations very low.
We hear, you know, you hear that, but I think that's not the reality. The states have regulated oil and gas production since a Supreme Court decision in 1900, and they are the main regulators and have been the regulators. And what we see in the states, so the states that have been doing it for a long time have well-established systems. The notion that kind of they're going to be lobbied to be allowed to do a bad cement job is just, you know, kind of not the way it works. The interesting part are the states that have now moved into it, like Pennsylvania and Ohio, which have to establish regulatory systems. And I've talked to Governor Rendell, who's the governor of Pennsylvania, and Governor Kasich, and what the states are doing is learning from basically other states how to do it. It does take investment in terms of resources. You really need to staff up to do it. And typically, you know, one way or the other, the companies operating are taxed to do it. And so, you know, we have the system, but you do need to ensure kind of best practices. The argument in favor of the states largely doing it, they're closer to the population levels, and the federal government doesn't necessarily have the capabilities actually to do it.
So long term, are we looking at all of the above, as President Obama and Republicans too have said, or are we looking at all of the above for the short term until we can find something, a renewable somewhere, the technology that we don't have yet to ensure our long-term energy survival?
I think for the long term, we need continuing innovation, both in supply, in new technologies, alternatives, and at the same time, we need to become a lot more efficient in how we use energy. In the quest, I refer to energy efficiency as the fifth fuel. Maybe I should have called it the first fuel, because it's not glamorous. There's no red ribbon to cut, but it really can have an enormous impact. But we've seen, take wind. Part of the U.S. wind industry is centered here in Atlanta in terms of manufacturing. And the wind industry, you know, people call it alternatives, but it has evolved so much over the last 30 years, I don't think it's an alternative anymore. I think it's a conventional form of electricity. It's just a new one. You know, so where will the ultimate sources be? I think after 2030, the energy system may start to look quite different than it is today. Solar, the cost of solar may be much more efficient and have an impact, and things we haven't thought of. Maybe we will be growing more of our energy. We're going to see the system evolve, and it really has to evolve, not only to meet environmental objectives, but to meet the needs of a world economy that in 20 or 25 years may be twice the size as it is today. So, you know, we need all of the above and then some.
Daniel Juergen is chairman of IHS Energy Research Associates. His book is The Quest, Energy Security and the Remaking of the Modern World. He joined us in Atlanta at a conference on energy and security with former Georgia Senator Sam Nunn. Dr. Juergen, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
And thank you.